From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we revisit a conversation with Issa Rae about her new HBO show, Insecure.
We wanted to just tell a story about regular people that happen to be black. Like, we didn't want to, like, hit you over the head with the fact that, oh, my God, we're black and all black issues, because we just wanted just to create something real.
That's coming up. First, though, yesterday we spoke with Democratic Senate candidate Jim Barksdale. He spoke about the influence of money in American politics.
What I'm arguing is that the balance has been upset and that the voice of the people has been not present at the table, and that the bills keep getting written to benefit large corporations that have harmed American workers.
Here are your first thoughts. Adam Dean tweets, "Thank you for your interview with Mr. Barksdale. That was the first opportunity I've had to hear him speak." And John Wilcox emailed us and said, "I wish each Senate candidate would tell us what they think could be done to reduce the extreme partisanship that we see in Washington. I know each is tempted to say, defeat my opponent and all members of his party, but that approach is futile. Neither party will ever eliminate the other party, and both parties are guilty." Well, John, we will have a chance to ask that question of Johnny Isaacson in just a moment, but we want to get your opinions on all kinds of things. So call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Incumbent U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson is expected to win a third term in this year's election. Yesterday, we spoke with his opponent, businessman and Democratic candidate Jim Barksdale. Today, we talked to Republican Isaacson about his plans should he return to Washington to represent Georgia. And Senator Isaacson joins me now. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you.
Let me put to you first that question from one of our listeners, John Wilcox, who says he wants to know what you think can be done to reduce extreme partisanship. It's no news to you that the past five or six Congresses have been among the least productive in American history, modern American history. How do we get rid of some of the partisanship in Washington?
Well, you have to work for the right goals, regardless of which parties form or who might be proposing them. And I've always tried in my career to find the best of proposals and work together with Democrats and Republicans alike to make them happen. And just for example, in the last 2 years, I've been a partner with Bob Menendez, a Democrat in New Jersey, to reform the federal flood insurance program, which was a hugely controversial issue and was partisan to begin with, but we passed with significant majorities. And I worked with the president to ratify the New START Treaty 3 years ago, which is an important move forward in terms of controlling our nuclear weapons production. So it can be done. It, like most things, what matters is your attitude.
So why have these past few Congresses been so unproductive? Why is business getting jammed up on Capitol Hill?
Well, my reason or my explanation is that this president, more than any president in the past, has used executive orders to circumvent the legislative process, and the Democrats, and although in the minority, have enough to deny cloture, have boxed the Republicans in to where there's no debate on the floor. It's all executive orders by the president and lawsuits before the Supreme Court against the president. So I think the initiation of the president to try and rule by executive order and avoid the legislative process has caused more partisanship than anything else that's happened in Washington.
So you don't feel that your party, the Republicans, have had any part in blocking business on Capitol Hill?
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay.
What I said was I thought the principal reason was the president had decided to avoid the legislative process by ruling strictly with executive order. That does not mean that all hands are not dirty. It means that that's the principal reason it's become so partisan.
So let me ask you about the Veterans Affairs Committee. That's something you've been a chairman of that committee for more than a year now. And that's an issue that for some reason our nation has struggled for some time and we haven't quite reached a place in which we're handling veterans affairs properly, either in hospitals or medical offices, or in terms of getting them the help that we need. What needs to be done?
Well, what needs to be done is there needs to be a real shakeup at the VA. Now, let me begin this answer by telling you this. There are 6.5 million veterans who get their health care through the Veterans Administration Health Services. And there are 314,000 employees in the Veterans Administration delivering those services. With numbers that big, from time to time, you're going to have staff stories to come out. The unfortunate thing is, when serving our veterans, the VA more often than not has had slips and falls in some very prominent areas. We had three suicides in the VA in Atlanta a couple of years ago, which prompted the nationwide analysis of the number of veterans committing suicide on a daily basis, which we know now is approximately 22 or 8,000 a year. And it's taken until this year for us to finally get a new hotline established so that every veteran at risk for their own life can call the phone, get a trained professional to counsel with them immediately. That was not available before. It will open up in Atlanta, Georgia in November. So that's one lagging problem that is we're about to overcome through the initiative of the Veterans Affairs Committee and the VA itself. But there are others that have to be done. We need to do a better job of seeing to it services are available to our veterans on a timely basis and no one waits too long for an appointment.
So I wanted to ask you, our listeners are tweeting in with questions that they have for
sure.
You. So we have one from Robert Jimison who says, what message does Senator Isaacson have for young minority voters who face crushing student loan debt and few good paying jobs that might help them pay off those debts?
Well, the thing I've always said and what you started this interview out by talking about why I'm running for a third term and what I intend to do. What I intend to do is see to it that every American who's qualified to get a job has a job available, and that means empowering the private sector, having incentives in government for private sector to deliver more jobs to our citizens. That's the number one way to alleviate our largest problem, which is not enough employment available for those seeking it. With that said, student debt is an issue that's gotten way out of hand. It's gotten out of hand because of a lot of folks. One is public education has raised its prices an awful lot because of the amount of credit that's available to students, and a lot of students who are borrowing money to go to school really aren't qualified or prepared to take on the debt they're taking on. But that's not something we need to blame them on. That's something we need to address and see to we structure student lending so they don't get borrowed too much over their head.
My guest is Senator Johnny Isaacson. He's a Republican running for his third term in the Senate this November. You said you wanted to empower the private sector. In what ways, what specifically does that mean?
Well, the three things I would do, number one, is manage our regulatory environment. Government has a role to see to it that competition can compete on a level playing field, but right now we're overly regulated where government's picking the winners and the losers. Business is sitting on its hands, it's sitting on capital. Our growth rate is only 1.4%. Therefore, you don't have the jobs available that you should have to move forward, and that's unfortunate. That's number one. Number two, we ought to have a tax policy that's pro-growth, that incentivizes the investment of capital in future business expansion and value-added process, not just sit on our capital and wait for somebody else to come into office. And third, and most importantly, goes back to the education question. We need to empower every single American in public schools to get a quality education and graduate with a high school diploma. And then we need to promote the STEM sort of subjects, science, technology, energy, and math, to make sure that kids are prepared for the jobs of the 21st century.
So here's another question from Ayman Hossam Fadl, listening right now, who asks, how will the war on terror end? Have you considered how we might be able to bring the war on terror to a close?
Terror on 9/11/2001 was the first battle of the ultimate war between good and evil, which probably, in a sense, will never end because terror is something one individual can inflict on another individual or on a community or on an institution at any particular time because of its very nature, and it's hard to stop it universally. But I will tell you this. Our current policy against ISIL, which is the heart and soul of terrorism, is containment. Containment is not the right policy. We need to eradicate them. We need to put troops on the ground where necessary. We need to command a force of the willing in the Middle East. We need to go after ISIL and run them away. You've got to cut the head of the snake off or you'll never stop the proliferation of terrorism.
So you have stood by an endorsement of Donald Trump. This is something that your opponent, Jim Barksdale, has focused on from time to time. Many other Republicans, including former presidents, have declined to endorse him. Why do you stand by that endorsement?
Well, first of all, he's the nominee of my party, and as I said months ago when I was interviewed on the subject, I'm going to support my ticket and support my party. My political activity is to support my reelection to the Senate because the most I can do for Georgia is as a United States Senator. I'm not a surrogate for nor a campaign manager for anybody else. I'm working for my reelection, and I support the party that I run under.
But what do you think is fueling the anger that is feeding Donald Trump's run for the president and helped to fuel Bernie Sanders' run for the nomination? I mean, I think there's no doubt that there is a sign of a simmering anger among especially middle class and working class voters in the U.S. What is behind that?
Celeste, that is a great question because that is the heart and soul of this election. Bernie Sanders on the left and Donald Trump on the right both benefited in the primaries for something I don't think either one of them really saw coming, but they caught it early, and they caught a wind at their back, and they got the Bernie almost got the nomination and probably would have had it not been for superdelegates. Trump did get the nomination, and that was a palpable anger in the American public and a frustration with an overly regulatory government, an overly bureaucratic government, and too long a period of recovery from the 08 recession. So I think both the left and the right have constituencies within their philosophy that are angry at the American government for the lack of movement forward on getting rid of overly burdensome regulation, empowering the individual, and empowering public education.
But, you know, I mean, I'm a working class voter. Regulation doesn't really inhibit my activities most of the time, but I'll tell you what does is the wage gap. And here in Georgia, we have one of the largest income inequality rates of anywhere in the country. How do you hope to bridge that gap?
Well, you know, I ran a business for 33 years, and I employed over 1,000 women at Northside Realty who were very successful. We've created opportunity and value-added process to build a real estate business and build a career and build a way to retire. I think creating jobs and opportunity is the best way to eliminate income inequality, not a government mandate for some type of formula.
Well, I'm just to push back on that. I mean, the income inequality, we're talking about the growth in a CEO salary, which in the U.S. has seen rise of like over 700% in the past, you know, couple decades, whereas regular middle class wages, in some cases, if they're adjusted for inflation, haven't risen at all. In fact, they've lost ground. So how do you address that?
There are good examples and there are bad examples, and you've talked about the bad example. Let me talk about the good example. People like Dan Amos, the president of Aflac in Columbus, Georgia, one of the largest supplemental insurance companies in the world, has put his salary up for a vote of the board of directors and put his compensation up for a vote of the stockholders. That's the type of accountability you need in corporations. Corporations are companies that are owned by their stockholders, and the CEO should not have unbridled opportunity to raise their own salary without accountability to their own stockholders. That's the way you do that.
Is you put salaries up for vote?
Well, that's what Dan Amos has done. You put it up for a vote of the stockholders, not a vote of the consumers, but a vote of the stockholders. They own the company. If you have a problem with a corporation and its policies, you go to the stockholders to change that. You don't try and change it from the outside.
That is Republican Johnny Isaacson. He's running for a third term as Georgia's U.S. Senator. And a confident senator at this point of a win?
You know, I'm never confident. I believe the choice of the voters of Georgia. What I'm trying to do is make sure that every single day of the year I'm out there doing everything I can to do the job they elected me to do, and that the election will be a ratification of me doing a good job, or if not, it'll be a ratification of someone else to replace me. I'm going to work hard to see it's me that gets reelected.
GPB will host the Atlanta Press Club debates here later this month. The U.S. Senate debate will air Sunday, October 23rd at 6 p.m. And just before that, the 3rd Congressional District debate airs at 5:30. Senator Isaacson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Celeste. Have a great day.
You too.